This is File 12, Cycle 3. Today's date is November 28, 2017. This is Jean McMillan. I am interviewing Reverend Heidi Truax, who is the current Reverend at Trinity Episcopal Church in Lime Rock, Connecticut. She's going to talk about her background, her previous career, and her career path to becoming a minister, and anything she wants to tell me about Trinity Church. So here we go. First, we'll start with a genealogical information. What is your name?
My name is Heidi Truax.
That sounds like a good start. And what is your birth date?
December 3, 1955.
And where were you born?
In Santa Ana, California.
You are the second California girl today I've talked with.
Oh.
And what were your, or are your parents' names?
Were. My mom has died. Betty Hewitt Lorenz.
L-O-R-E-N-Z.
Right. Yeah.
And your father?
Hans Lorenz.
Okay. And you don't have siblings, do you?
No.
You're an only.
Yeah.
We are special. How did you come to this area?
Well, my husband and I met in California and got married. I was 18, he was 19. We went to UC Santa Barbara together, built a house in Santa Barbara, and started having babies all at the same time. And then when our children were 5, 4, 2, and newborn, Philip's grandfather died in Sharon, Connecticut, and gave us his house, and we moved here.
With all four children?
Well, yeah.
Oh, bless your heart.
And so we stood in our beautiful house and said, this is great, this is marvelous, but now what are we going to do for a living?
Oh, yes.
Need to do that. So we ended up opening up first one computer store, and then two more.
Good heavens.
And then we sold the whole business as it was. The stores were opened in 82, 83, and 84, but then they were all sold by 1989 because the computer business changed so fast.
Yeah.
And so our first store was right on Main Street in Sharon.
Oh.
And it was called Sharon Computer.
Okay.
And at the beginning we sold Eagle Computers. And then, interestingly enough, we turned in a business plan to Apple, and they rejected us.
Oh, dear.
They said Sharon was too small of a town. But we turned in the business plan to IBM, and they accepted us, which I thought was very strange.
Yeah.
You've got the business that was born in a garage versus, you know, the huge corporation with many, many huge offices.
But Poughkeepsie is closer than California.
That may be part of it, right? That may be part of it. Anyway, so we were an IBM dealership there right off the bat, and we opened a store in New Milford and also one in Torrington.
How did you staff all of that?
We just did, you know. It was an exciting time, and people were interested in being in the computer,
forefront,
home computer phase of life. And what was funny about it, though, is that most people who first came in the door in the very beginning, very first years, they would come in the door and look around at all the computers, and then they'd say, "What would I do with a computer? Should I buy a computer? Do I need one?"
Oh, yes.
We taught a lot of computer classes, and we gave a lot of instruction. Computers weren't as user-friendly as they are now.
Oh, no,
took a lot more knowing how to plug and knowing how to boot them up and put in the commands. And it was much more of a big deal to get a computer back in 1982.
Yes, I was still teaching then, and I was using computers reluctantly.
Mm-hmm.
I had a legally blind child, and there were programs on the computer she could deal with.
Oh, great.
And then I had other children that were
mathematically challenged, mm-hmm. and there were computer programs yes. that helped strengthen those activities.
Yes.
So I was using it, but I was not a gung-ho computer person.
Most people weren't, I don't mm. think. I think a lot of people didn't see the value of computers to begin with, especially in the days before the internet.
Yeah, yeah.
So then in 89, the writing was on the wall that things were changing very fast and that computers were now being sold in Staples and Sears and other large stores. Mm-hmm. And the little mom-and-pop computer store became pretty rapidly a thing of the past.
Yeah.
And so we started doing the business out of our home at that point. And Philip would go to people's place of business and work on their computers there.
What happened after you sold the computer stores?
Our computer business
was
continued
at home.
At home in a different manner. And then, so that was from like 90 to 94. In 95, we had 200 phone lines installed into our home. Actually into the office building right next to
mm-hmm.
our home,
mm-hmm.
and we became an internet service provider.
Good Lord.
And because at that time, if you remember, the only way to get on the internet was to dial into AOL.
Yes, yes.
And it was always a long-distance number.
Yes, and it took forever.
And it took forever.
Yep.
And so now you could dial a local number, mm-hmm. a Sharon number,
mm-hmm.
and get into the internet.
Ah.
And so we became Mohawk Internet. And so still did some computer repair and sales, but then started branching more into website design and maintenance and hosting.
Wow. I'm impressed.
Well, you have to keep changing.
Yeah.
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 The technology changes so fast.
And it's changed so much from then
right.
to now.
Exactly. No more dial-up modems.
No. And everything is smaller. I mean, the tower used to be huge, and now
right.
it's, you know, smaller.
Tiny. Yeah.
And there's Google Earth, and there's MapQuest, and so people don't need to use a road map or an
right.
atlas anymore.
Right.
And if you have a question, like on the doing a crossword puzzle, instead of using your crossword puzzle dictionary, you go to the computer.
Right, right.
So it's become a very necessary, in quotes,
yes.
part of our society.
It is.
But how wonderful that you have all of those skills.
Well, yes, except that those skills are now sort of antiquated, because the things I knew how to do were back in the 90s. Right, and things have progressed a lot since then. But still, yes, the theories are the same,
mm-hmm.
certainly, and software has the same look to it now. And so the boys grew up. They all went to Sharon Center School.
Oh,
they,
good.
They all went to Hoosie.
Did you have four boys?
Yeah.
And their names?
Aaron, A-A-R-O-N.
Yeah.
Tobias.
Yeah.
Matthew Hontz, who we end up calling Hontz most of the time.
How do you spell Hontz?
H-A-N-S, like his grandfather.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And Luke.
Not Lucas, but Luke.
Right, just Luke.
Good. All right.
So they all went to Hoosie, and they all graduated between 95 and 2000.
And then you were free.
Yeah. And then I was kind of casting about saying, you know, I really didn't enjoy computer sales all that much
mm.
or doing bookkeeping
mm-hmm.
for Philip's business all that much. What would I like to do? And I had been very involved with Christchurch Sharon.
Yep.
I was in the choir and on the vestry, and I was treasurer there for 6 years. And I started feeling as though perhaps God was calling me to ordained ministry.
Good.
And so put together a discernment team there at Christchurch. One little funny story about that is I was told to not pick cheerleaders, but to pick people for the discernment committee who would honestly help me understand my my strengths and my weaknesses.
Okay.
And so not people who would just say, oh, you're just great.
Uh-huh.
Oh, you're marvelous.
Well, you are.
So, but one person I did not choose was an elderly person who I knew did not approve of female ministers.
Ah.
And I thought, well, there's no point asking her to be on, even though she's a lovely person and I liked her very much. She liked me. But it was a foregone conclusion what she was going to say.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the sermon committee went on for 2 years, though. And halfway through, she, who was Gertrude Schley, I don't know if you remember Gertrude Schley.
How do you spell Schley?
S-C-H-L-E-Y. She lived in Sharon all her life,
mm-hmm.
and her mother before her.
Mm-hmm.
Gertrude said, Heidi, how come you never asked me to be on your discernment committee? And I said, well, Gertrude, I didn't think you'd really want to be on my discernment committee. And she said, well, yes, I do. And I said, but I knew that you don't believe in women being priests.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, well, that's for other people. I would believe in you being a priest.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Isn't that funny?
That is so wonderful.
Gertrude came onto she was a marvelous person. Just marvelous. I miss her terribly.
Mm-hmm.
She died when I was in seminary, and so I even missed her funeral. So that was probably in about 2003 when she died.
Oh, my.
But wonderful woman.
Where did you go to seminary?
Yale Divinity. Although I should clarify, Berkeley,
mm-hmm.
At Yale. Berkeley is the Episcopal Divinity School housed at Yale Divinity.
Okay. And when did you become ordained?
In 2005.
And you started your divinity journey in 2000?
In January of 2000. Yeah, they let people start half year at that point.
Oh, good.
They don't anymore. So I started.
And if I remember correctly, you are a deacon first.
Yes.
And then you become a priest in charge?
Priest.
Priest.
Because of the office which you hold in a church has a different set of names than your ordination title.
Okay.
So.
And
yeah.
You were ordained January 2006?
That's to the priesthood, yeah.
To the priesthood.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
All right. We've got to get that straight.
Right, right.
Okay. Now, you had a wonderful story about getting a church in Roxbury.
Oh, yes. That's funny. Yes. Of course, just to very quickly say, so from 2005 to 2008, I was the curate at Trinity Southport, because you need to take a position where you are learning under somebody.
Mm-hmm.
So, and a lot of these titles are from the old English church, so that there's just all the vicar and curate and
these
things. But that was my title. And then I went for a year to Honduras, and I was a missionary in Honduras with the Episcopal Church. Then I came back here, hoping to find a church somewhere near so that I could still live at home.
Mm-hmm.
And I started applying to all the open parishes that were around, and one of them was Roxbury. This parish wasn't available. Somebody was here at Trinity Lime Rock.
Mm-hmm.
And I went through that interview process, and I found out that I was one of two people.
Oh, great.
I was so close, and I was getting excited that maybe I would get that church in Roxbury. And then the senior warden from this church called me up one day, and I had been doing supply work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so Linda asked me if I was available to do some supply work. And I said, well, sure, I haven't gotten a job yet, so, you know, absolutely. And she said, yeah, our priest just left. He got a job at Roxbury, so, we need somebody to supply. And I said, oh, all right. Well, I guess I didn't get the job in Roxbury. But it turned out to be quite a blessing in disguise.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Because first I was supply priest here for a little while, beginning in summer of 2009. And then I became priest in charge. appointed by the bishop from November 1st for another couple of years, and then I was elected to be the rector, which is sort of like a teacher with tenure. Once you have been elected as the rector, you can basically stay as long as you would like.
Oh, good.
Assuming no malfeasance.
they don't move you around then?
No, not if you're a rector. A priest in charge, yes.
Yes.
Or a vicar or any of those other designations. Those are all ones where the bishop has charge of you. But once you're a rector, you have a little more...
You can stay.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Good.
Exactly.
When specifically did you come to Trinity as priest in charge?
Well, November 1st, 2009.
Okay, you had said November 1st, but I didn't get the year. Okay, so you're still a newbie.
But now, of course, rector. So
now you can stay.
Yeah.
Do you wish to stay?
Yeah. I'm in another few days, I will be 62.
Oh, I remember those years.
My birthday's December 3rd.
Yeah.
And so I would not relish the idea of, trying to find some bigger, better job somewhere. I'm very happy here.
And it's close to home. You know the people. You know the area. And
right.
I would think that would be a lot easier on you.
Much easier.
Good.
Yeah.
Well, I, for one, think it's wonderful. Do you have a mission statement for the church?
Yes. It was created before I came, so I don't have any credit for it, but it's a marvelous one. Mm-hmm. Offering companionship along the way.
Oh, good.
And so I love the way that's kind of open-ended, and people can imagine whatever their way is.
Yep.
And
every way is different.
Yeah.
People are different. That's
exactly.
That's wonderful. Now, I now know what an ASA is,
so I'm
going to ask you what your average Sunday attendance is.
I taught you that last time, right?
Yes, you did.
It, unfortunately, has gone down over the years I've been here, and now we stand at about 65 or so.
Well, you'll be happy to know that St. John's is 66, so you're not doing badly. That's what I was told.
Yeah, I'm sure. Okay.
But that's combining the 8 o'clock and the 10 o'clock
yes.
service. Now, do you do two services or just
yes.
one? You do an 8 o'clock and a 10 o'clock?
Yes.
And what's the difference, please?
Well, you mean the difference in the services or
yeah.
the numbers?
The difference in the services.
The 8 o'clock is rite one, meaning we use Elizabethan English, and there's no music, so it's a short service. And it's also intimate, and people sit in the choir rather than down in the pews.
Ah, okay.
So we're all gathered up there on the chancel area.
Is there always communion?
Yes. The only time there isn't these days is when I'm on vacation.
Okay.
And then we do morning prayer.
I'm going to ask how you do communion.
Well, at the altar rail, with wine and wafers.
Okay, you still use the wafers.
Sometimes we have fresh bread when our Sunday school or our teenagers make it.
Okay.
When it's kind of a special occasion. And in fact, our confirmation class, the two boys are being confirmed next week. I'm still backstuck on that ASA number. I'm sorry. David and I did a pulpit swap once.
Ah.
And so I know who's over there.
Well, it was, I told him this story. My brother-in-law, Henry Kiera, was 27 years at St. John's back in the 40s and the 50s. And one of the Scoville women, when he was a newbie, told him exactly how he should run his church. And he thanked her very nicely because he was a very polite Italian gentleman. And he said, but I will run it my way. And she left the church.
Oh.
Along with all of her money.
Yeah.
Didn't bother him.
Well, that was back in the day, wasn't it?
It was.
Yeah.
It was. Things are different now.
Right.
But And the reason that I asked about communion is that I went to an Anglican church when I was in England, and I was there for Easter. And Father Rothopi said, "Now, as you know, I want you all to come to the altar rail." And I'm thinking, this is a little strange because, you know, the four-year-olds are running up the aisle.
Yeah.
And so I went up to take communion, and the adults got wine and wafer. The kids got chocolate Easter eggs.
Well, that's odd.
Yeah, well, it was. I was very surprised at that. But that was his. That was what he did for the children.
Okay.
So that they would participate in the Easter service. And I wanted a chocolate Easter egg, too.
Right.
Now, tell me about the 10 o'clock service. Is that more of a formal service with music?
So it's not any more or less formal than the 8 o'clock, because we are a church that uses the Book of Common Prayer.
Mm-hmm.
And so we use that book at both services.
Yep.
So the difference with the 10:30, and ours is 10:30,
okay.
So because we have a Bible study in between the two services. The difference is that it's a modern language,
mm-hmm.
and that there is wonderful music, and
it would be.
A nice choir, and so the service takes a little bit longer to get through than the 8 o'clock.
That's reasonable.
And then there's a coffee hour.
Oh, yes. Then you must have a hospitality committee that does the coffee hour?
We have six rotating teams. And so all the parishioners are assigned to one or another of the teams.
Ah, I see. So everybody in the church has something to do.
Yes.
Oh, good. Oh, good. You have a Sunday school?
We do now.
Okay.
Sometimes it goes up and sometimes it goes down. But we've now got about 10 kids.
Oh, good. And how about a youth group, teenagers?
Well, it's all one.
It's all one.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's both teenagers and kids, because there aren't enough of any one particular. But as I say, I've got two teenagers being confirmed this Sunday by the bishop.
And who teaches? Do you teach the confirmation class?
Yes.
Okay. And tell me about the Bible study. Is this open to anybody in the congregation?
Oh, yeah, of course.
And do you lead it?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Sometimes we have guest leaders, guest theologians or Bible experts, but usually it's just me.
Okay.
And the reason I liked positioning it between the 8 and the 10:30 is because we have some of the 8 o'clock that stay late for it, and some of the 10:30ers come
early. Oh, that makes a lot of sense. It really does.
The only thing that we miss out on in that case is that the people in the choir can't attend, because they have their choir rehearsal at that time. So I'm sorry about that, because there are a couple of people, I think, that would attend the Bible study if it weren't all at the same time.
With your Bible study, is there a prescribed series, or do you just pick whatever you want to pick?
I kind of let the group decide on the next book, and we kind of flip back and forth between Old and New Testament books. And sometimes somebody has heard something in church that has sparked their interest and makes them feel like they'd like to know more about that particular book.
Okay.
So we just kind of go the way the Holy Spirit blows us.
I like that. Now, because of the church structure, you have a vestry.
Right.
And is that where your six rotating teams come in, or?
No.
No, all right.
The six rotating teams are just parishioner-led and parishioner-organized.
Okay. Then do you have, like, a finance committee and a...
No.
No.
We don't really need a finance committee, because all of the endowment that we have is with the diocesan investments.
Okay.
They have the diocese has a big group of financial experts, and they use, I can't even remember what bank it is now, and so our money is invested with a large pool of parishes' monies.
How many deacons do you have?
We don't have any deacons, because for us, a deacon is an ordained position. Come here. And there are deacons in the Episcopal Church.
And I thought so.
They are assigned to various parishes, but we only have, I learned this at our annual convention 2 weeks ago that we only have 29 deacons, and we have 160 parishes, 150, between 150 and 160, I can't remember what the number is now. And so obviously those deacons are spread thinly. And the bishop has charge of the deacons and assigns them where he or she will.
But you do have a vestry.
Yes.
And how many on your vestry?
11.
Okay. Who is the current bishop?
We have two bishops. There's a diocesan bishop, you know, the head bishop. His name is Ian Douglas.
Wouldn't be Scotch, would he?
Yes, he would.
Okay.
And then there's a suffragan bishop.
A which?
Suffragan, or under bishop.
Okay.
And her name is Laura Ahrens, A-H-R-E-N-S. And she's the one who's coming on Sunday to confirm the two boys.
Oh, good. Alrighty. And you just told me that if you become a rector or a vicar...
Yeah, not a vicar.
A rector.
Yeah.
A rector.
Uh-huh.
You don't have to rotate.
Right.
Good. Tell me about the juried art show that's been developed. Something that was not necessarily from you, but from the congregation?
Yeah, specifically from Marianne Carley. She is the brains and the brawn behind the whole thing. Our parish has had an invitational art show for 30-plus years.
Oh, yeah.
But that now has been retired.
Okay.
For a couple of years, we had both, once Marianne started this idea of the juried art shows, we had both running because people didn't want to let go of the invitational show.
Mm-hmm.
But this summer, it became clear that the juried art shows had completely eclipsed the invitational one, and we didn't have it. Nobody seemed to miss it. Nobody stuck up their hand in church and said, hey,
wait a minute.
Right.
Yeah.
Because they all knew that if they did that, I'd say, fine, you do it.
Yes, you've been here long enough so that you know where the bodies are buried. Yep, okay.
So that it's been a wonderful thing because the committee that Marianne formed is mostly of people not in the church, but from the community, artists from the community that are her committee. And it draws, you know, a huge number of people, and the artists seem to love it, and the people who come to look or buy seem to love it, so all is well. I've got another funny little story to tell you, though.
Oh, good. Oh, good.
And it's appropriate of the apropos of the season.
Okay.
So about 6 years ago, Christine Gevert, mm-hmm. our choir mistress, and I came up with the idea that Lime Rock has never had a Christmas tree lighting like all the other towns, and even if we're just a hamlet, we have this beautiful tree out front. And she said, you know, the choir would love to sing carols, and we could pick a day and a time and light the Christmas tree and sing carols. And I said, I thought that was a fine idea.
Mm-hmm.
And I contacted Mike Root and asked
yes.
if he would be willing to bring his bucket truck and put up the lights, and he said he would. And Jeff Silvernail, who does our outside work, our mowing and all of that, and he's also a parishioner, he kind of coordinated the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so we put up the lights, and we sang carols and drank hot chocolate, and everybody loved it, and we started, the compliments started pouring in. Oh, what a beautiful tree that is. I've never seen Lime Rock look so lovely.
Mm-hmm.
It's wonderful to come up over that hill on 112 and see the lit up tree. It's so marvelous. And of course, we you know, complimented and promoted Mike Root as being the one who volunteered to put up the lights. So we've been doing that now. But the first year I did it, I was talking to a couple of my fellow priests in other Episcopal parishes.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, we've got a new thing this year. We're going to do a Christmas tree lighting in Lime Rock. We're going to put up the lights and sing carols. And the one other priest, a woman, she looked at me aghast. How can you do that? And I said, well, it's for the community. And she said, that is just not appropriate. I said, oh, because it's Advent? And she said, that's right. You're not supposed to light a Christmas tree or sing Christmas carols in Advent. Advent's a time of preparation and quiet and soul-searching. In preparation for the nativity. Mm-hmm. So I spoke to another couple of priests, and they said they agreed, you know, Advent is just not the time to do this. So finally I called up the bishop.
Good for you.
And I said, you know, Bishop, we're planning to do this Christmas tree lighting, but I'm getting kind of some flack from some of my fellow priests about this. And he said, well, why are you doing it? And I said, because the community really seems to like this idea and want it, and it's a great time for our little community that has nothing really to gather it together, to gather together. And he said, well, then it's perfect.
Go for it.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Wonderful. And what year did you start the Christmas tree lights?
2011.
Okay. Yeah, that would be about 6 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's 2011.
But there isn't any. I mean, Lime Rock is what you say in England was a line village. There's
yes.
no pub. There's no grocery store. There's right. no post office. There's right. no community center. There's nothing.
Right.
And with the tree lighting, it will bring people together.
Yeah, it has.
And that's wonderful. And that's the purpose of getting the neighbors together.
Right. So I just love that. And we finally even got the electrician out here to... install a plug right at the base of the tree.
Oh, good.
So that we don't have to run electric lines above ground.
Oh, seeing as how you're speaking about lights, tell me about the lights for the church.
Oh, right. Yes, yes. So, one of the things I noticed when I first arrived here is that if you come to Trinity Church at night, you see absolutely nothing. Black. Nothing lit in the on the street or in the lot or on the building, no sign, nothing, just complete darkness. And so the first thing that I had thought about and brought to the vestry was that we should at least light the sign. We've got a nice sign mm-hmm. out front. Mm-hmm. And that was the time at which we put in the plug at the tree and put in lights to shine on the sign and a light to shine on the front
church.
Of the building.
Because mm-hmm. it's a beautiful building.
Yeah. And so it was so nice in the years now to at least when you drive by at night
see
something.
It. Yeah.
But still, that really wasn't enough. The church has been lacking light all over the place. The church itself seems dark and very dark in places. The parish hall where we're doing the art shows, every time we did an art show, we had to put up those clip aluminum lights, shop lights, the cheap mm-hmm. lights that you
yep.
buy at a lumber yard. And there was no light in the parking lot. We have evening meetings and rehearsals and an AA meeting. And I was always kind of frightened of the fact that people were walking out there, they could trip over the bollards we have
yeah.
out there or whatever. So over the last few years, we have done sort of a Let There Be Light campaign, and we have put up new lights inside the church. We put up new specific lights to light our artwork in Walker Hall mm-hmm. and new lights in the parking lot.
And that's a blessing.
Yes.
Because I used to come to Christine's Crescendo concerts. And if I didn't remember my flashlight,
yes.
I was in deep trouble.
Yes. Yeah, it was terrible.
Now, you do all sorts of outreach programs, and you gave me your Easter bulletin,
yes.
and it lists about 20. And I'm going to ask you about a few of them.
Okay.
Camp Washington, what's that?
Camp Washington is our diocesan camp. And so it's a summer camp for kids in the summer, both ones that can afford it and ones that cannot, that have scholarships. And then also it's a sort of a retreat center for all of the parishes in the diocese to use. So if somebody wanted to have a vestry retreat or some event with their parish, they could go to Camp Washington.
Where's it located?
It's located very near Washington, Connecticut. It's actually in a little town called Lakeside.
Okay.
Which is kind of south of Litchfield.
You've got two entries for the New York Cycle Club, the lunch and the lunch stop. Why is that a connection?
Well, how things just happen because they happen. And one year, I think this started maybe a year or two before I arrived too, the New York Cycle Club does a big ride on Memorial Day weekend from up in the Berkshires down into Connecticut. I'm not exactly sure where their start and stop is. But they somehow were in contact with Jeff Brown, who runs our website.
Okay.
And he encouraged them to stop and use the bathrooms, charge phone. And then we decided that, gee, since they're stopping, let's sell them some snacks and Gatorade and water and all of that. And so that the event has kind of grown over the years because they've come to expect it.
Yes.
And we've come to enjoy doing it. We don't make a ton of money at all of this.
No, but it's a goodwill effort.
Yeah.
It's a goodwill effort.
So now we also sell them sandwiches. Sometimes we have an art show up at the same time.
Oh, okay.
Of course, they can't really go down the road carrying a painting. But
they can fold it up.
We certainly could ship it to them.
Oh, sure. Oh, you're being very, very clever. Tell me about furnishing a home for a refugee family.
Right. So we partnered with St. Mary's, now St. Martin of Tours, of course.
Mm-hmm.
They had the lead on this of bringing a Syrian family in. They had the training from IRIS, Integrated Refugee
International
Immigrant Resettlement.
Thank you.
And it's not still not quite. I still don't have it exactly right, but
it's close enough.
Yeah.
It's close enough.
So, what IRIS does as a semi-governmental organization is they actually bring the people over here, and then they find partners to help get the families settled. And, of course, when President Obama was still in office, we had a large number of families coming, and IRIS was processing a lot of families. So they were training anybody who wanted to be trained, a group of individuals or a church or a school, to be able to help get a family settled and let them walk them through what the requirements were to become a resettled refugee family. We, at the same time, we're investigating this with IRIS, but just wanting to, we imagined that they would have to be settled in a city.
Yeah.
And that we would provide some help to a group that was already doing this in the city. And so we were so surprised to learn that IRIS was considering settling a family here up in the northwest corner. Because I'm thinking there aren't many jobs.
No.
There's no public transportation.
No.
They're not near
anything.
IRIS for, they have to get their health screenings done in New Haven. And so I was thinking that this wouldn't be possible, but when we met, our people met with the people of St. Mary's, we found out that, it was going to be possible. They had worked out all the details.
Okay.
And we said, we would love to partner with you and we would love to help. So our task became furnishing the house.
Oh, my word.
Yeah. And
word.
We were the hub of getting clothing and towels and sheets and blankets and beds. And of course, there were many other people that helped. But it was a monumental task.
That's a major undertaking.
To get that house all furnished and ready to go for the family.
And where is the house actually located?
It's in Salisbury. A kind woman who owns it. It's sort of across from the White Hart on 44, kind of back a little bit into the woods.
Yeah,
and so she's renting it to them for a very
nominal fee.
Yeah, nominal amount.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, So it all worked out very well, and we just had the family here at Trinity for the first time at the Interfaith Thanksgiving service on Tuesday. And because we had, you know, that service goes around to different parishes or different denominations. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so we had Jewish people and the Muslim family and Buddhists. And
I hope you had a Unitarian representative.
Yes. Yes, Dave Clement and Joe Loy.
Oh, good.
And
Joe Loy.
Kiao.
Oh, good. Good. Because Joe and Kiao have picked it up. Foster used to do it frequently, and then Lou Burgess did it.
Oh, great.
So that, you know, it would be an ecumenical service that I would go to because my husband was participating in it.
Right, right.
Which was quite interesting.
Yeah.
And does the Greek Orthodox, if he's Greek?
Yes, it's Orthodox.
Orthodox.
They call themselves, I think, American Orthodox.
Okay.
It's sort of a combination between Greek and Russian.
Yeah, I'm interviewing him next Thursday at 5:30.
Okay. Good.
We tried to find a time and a place.
Yeah.
And he was willing to come up here after work, which is great.
Good.
Now, tell me about a little bit about Trinity Glen, because that's where he works.
Yes, that's where he works. So I am a person in recovery myself. Mm-hmm. And so I learned about Trinity Glen because when I was newly sober, I was going around to all the different meetings. We are encouraged to do 90 and 90. 90 meetings in 90 days, so that you set the pattern of getting out of your house and getting out of isolation and
that's
getting
good.
To a meeting.
That's good.
And so one or two of the meetings every week was at Trinity Glen, and I started driving their van pretty soon. I got sober back in 95, and so I started driving their van and driving their, at that time, guys and gals to meetings in the area, and now they have become men only. There's a woman's facility down in Kent.
Oh,
they
okay.
moved the women to a different facility, which okay. was pretty smart.
Yes.
So I've gotten to know the cycle of how guys come and go. They sign up for usually 6 months to a year, mm-hmm. and most often it's guys who have failed out of every other program available, and this is kind of the last chance. Although some come back to Trinity Glen, even if they haven't succeeded at Trinity Glen, they sometimes are accepted back, and we see some faces again. So I started once I went to seminary, I couldn't drive the van anymore. When I was at Trinity Southport, I couldn't.
I
was in Honduras, I couldn't. But once I moved back here in 2009, I took it back up again, and I drive them to a meeting here once a week, to the Wednesday night AA. And at some point I said, hey, if any of you guys would like to come to church on Sunday, I'm sure I could send a parishioner and you could come to church. So that has now become quite an ingrained pattern, too, is that one or more guys come on Sunday mornings to the church service.
Oh, that's good. Now, that's just alcoholic rehab, right?
And drug.
And drugs,
mm-hmm.
okay.
Yep.
What is, Mountainside in Canada?
Same thing, only not as long-term. And they have a detox. So Mountainside, you can come to that place if you're accepted, if you're still drunk, and they'll detox you, or still on drugs.
Yeah, okay.
They'll detox you. Then you can stay for a 30-day program, and you can extend it for another 30 days. And then they even have an extended program after that you can stay across the street in their little apartments or rooms across the street. And those are the people who work at Mountainside Cafe.
Yes, yes.
Right.
It used to be the Chinchilla Farm years and years ago.
Right.
Oh, my word. Northern Exposure Photography Club. Now, that's not the one that I was involved in. This is a different one.
This is Karen and Brad Smith mm-hmm. from Kent.
Okay.
And so they've had several photography shows here. Brad is kind of sick now, unfortunately.
Oh, dear.
So they haven't done that in the last couple of years.
No, the one that I was in was the Housatonic
Camera Club.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the name of the gentleman always escapes me who is running it now. Ah, man.
I ran it for a couple of years. I never got out of the B group. I was not a good photographer.
Oh.
But
But anyway, is there anything that you would like to add to this interview before we close? Or have I covered it?
Yeah, I'm sure there is. I should have thought ahead of time and tried to gather my thoughts into what's the most important thing about our parish and about my life now. I don't know if I mentioned that a couple of years I got divorced. And so that's not important for this interview at all. But
it's important for your life and your life path.
Yes, it is. And so now I've purchased a house just down the road a piece.
Oh, good.
And so I feel as though my life has gotten into a much more...
You're in a good place.
...sane, calm pattern between my home and my love of sports. I've got a bunch of friends I play paddle tennis with and
oh,
tennis.
Good.
And this parish, I guess it's just sort of a love of life as it is now.
Wonderful. And that's a great way of ending the interview. Thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you, Jean.
Perfect.